Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, your Case of the Mondays podcast, brought to you by your very favorite libertarian magazine. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mayhew Ward. Soggy Monday to all of you.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Catherine, did you do like the Sylvie Loki mind meld thing to drive off the evil storm that was going to crush your dreams?
Yeah, I did. I did. Out here on Long Island, I just did my very best Sylvie slash Enchantress routine. And instead of a exciting hurricane, we had a moderately annoying rainy day.
Okay. We're going to get to more rain, also Afghanistan, and some breaking, at least to us, in the morning of Monday, FDA news here in a second. But first, data privacy is now finally in your hands. Introducing Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in, that's right, Switzerland. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from various intrusive governments and laws. 100% homegrown technology, zero affiliation with big tech behemoths like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft. Secure is the choice for privacy hawks worldwide. Make the move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That's secure.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Much has transpired in Afghanistan since last this podcast convened. The U.S. and allied airlift, which looked kind of finished 10 days ago when we saw those awful images of people clinging to and then dropping from the wheel wells, is now up to 42,000 evacuees, including more than 10,000 in the past 24 hours alone. Taliban, when not posing for trollish Iwo Jima style flag recreation photo shoots, is saying that the August 31st deadline for the 6,000 or so U.S. troops to leave is a line in the sand. It'll have consequences if it is extended. The G7 is having an emergency meeting on Tuesday at which UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is expected to try to convince President Joe Biden to extend said deadline. Meanwhile, nationalist politicians in Europe and America are drawing their own lines in the sand about accepting or not accepting Afghan refugees. And there's been some reporting that President Biden has been taking that into account when not relaxing more quickly the various restrictions put into effect by his predecessor. Catherine, I suppose that I should stop being surprised by what seems to my casual consumption eyes to be everyone reacting to the various news by saying, yep, confirms my priors, rather than maybe looking at some of the things that they have said and done over the past 20 years that contributed to a policy debacle. So maybe as a way to start off our conversation, I would ask you to kind of reflect upon the following factlet. Not a factoid, by the way. Factoids are not true. Factlets are just little facts. This comes from the Tyndall Report. Quote, out of a combined 14,000 plus minutes of the national evening news broadcast on CBS, ABC, and NBC in 2020, a grand total of 5 minutes. That's five out of 14,000 minutes were devoted to Afghanistan. Catherine, how does that kind of set it and forget it mentality of what we were doing in Afghanistan until 2 weeks ago affects the way that we both have conducted policy and journalism thereof?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's not overvalue the evening news, which I personally have not ever seen, I don't think. So, this is a reasonable metric, a reasonable way to gauge how much attention people have been paying to Afghanistan. And the answer is certainly very, 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 very little in the last year, and a decreasing amount for many years, which is what the Tyndall Report shows. Setting aside just general slagging of the evening news, which I am always up for, the American public is basically totally indifferent to this two decades old war until it became a crisis and also an opportunity for, as you say, I told you so's, you know, similar to another war that Americans have been content to let rage on in the background, the war on drugs. Reason has been actually covering some of this stuff. I went looking because I saw this tidbit and I thought, you know, first of all, I thought, is this actually true? Because it did have a little bit of a ring of some sort of cherry picking of data. But the Tyndall Report is a real thing. But I went and looked at Reason's coverage just to see how we measured up. That 5-minute statistic is from 2020. Reason, during that same period, published 14 posts with an Afghanistan tag and over 60 posts with some reference to Afghanistan, including a surprising number of Afghanistan references from movie reviewer Kurt Loder. So I do think, you know, that is something that I'm proud of, I guess, at Reason, that we held on to this position, which all of the fancy muckety-mucks said was, you know, stupid, overly simplistic, childish, you know, the idea of we shouldn't be there and this is a disaster and we have to keep talking about it. It's the same with so many wars, including the war on drugs, and sometimes some voice somewhere saying we shouldn't be there, this is a disaster and we have to keep talking about it can make a difference. It does seem true that the quote-unquote mainstream media abdicated that responsibility. In their defense, we did have some other stuff to talk about in 2020, including a presidential election and a global pandemic.
Nick, I'm going to invite you to take seriously a critique from people who are more interventionist than you or me or any of us, probably. Basically, in the words of Noah Rothman from Commentary, but plenty of other people who we might know, all Biden had to do was nothing, which is to say he could have just kept on keeping on a small garrison, a small footprint of American soldiers there. The status quo, as unsatisfying as it was, at least wasn't the Taliban running absolutely amok, eating ice cream cones for the cameras and doing God knows what horrible things are out there. What is your response to that? Are they wrong? Are we wrong? What do you say?
Yeah, they're wrong because this is, you know, they're talking about something that comes at the end of literally 20 years, two decades. A large chunk of America wasn't even born when we first entered Afghanistan. And we went in with a specific mission, which was to get the person and the people behind 9/11. We screwed that up in Afghanistan. We could have been out in, you know, 2003, you know, or, you know, thereabouts. Yeah, you know, when we lost the trail of bin Laden and whatnot. And the idea that we could just maintain a small indefinite force where only one American or two Americans would be killed a month for eternity, you know, somehow that the idea that that's a stable equilibrium coming after two decades of something, after in the past year, the Taliban was actually gaining ground all over Afghanistan, because it is not our fight. We shouldn't have been in there in the first place. And the way that the United States is going to affect a world where more people are free to, you know, kind of live the lives that they see fit so that they can enjoy some of the benefits that we in the West and especially in America have historically done. It's not by leaving a garrison force to protect Kabul for, you know, for now and all eternity. It had to end in the same way that our occupation and our presence in hundreds of countries around the globe has got to end at some point. It is not our job. It is not right. It is not helping freedom or peace. The thing that people should be taking issue with now is not the idea of leaving Afghanistan any more than leaving Iraq. It's what our presence did there over the time where we destroyed possibilities for an Afghanistan that might have been more generative. And right now, what we are doing, and this is the thing, that the only thing that humiliates me and makes me ashamed as an American about the way that we're acting. And, you know, and I bring that up because so much of the coverage I saw was, you know, America is being humiliated, from hawks, you know, saying we're being humiliated because we're being kicked out of a capital city that we shouldn't have been in the first place. What I am humiliated by and ashamed of in terms of America at this present moment is that we are dawdling over taking in, you know, the numbers are anywhere from 50,000 to 80,000 Afghans who helped us, who have some kind of very legitimate claim on being taken in as a refugee status, and we're dicking around with that. That's what we should be focused on. How do we turn to a new form of humanitarianism that will actually help people who are in the most dire trouble now? And we're failing at that. That's what Joe Biden should be held accountable for, not for getting out of a war that everybody knew we shouldn't have been in for the better part of two decades.
I'm going to come back around with a follow-up on that question, Nick, in particular in a bit. But first, I want to go to Suderman. In looking around at the reaction, you live in Washington, the sort of Washington national security establishment and journalism thereof reaction to this. How does that confirm your priors, Peter Suderman, about the glaring lack of a more intervention skeptical Washington kind of intellectual class?
Yeah, I mean, as I have said before, there is just virtually no elite constituency for principled non-interventionist foreign policy in Washington. And if you look at the coverage here, just every day on, you know, the cable news, major media outlets, it really does seem to kind of prove that. There was even, you know, there was an interaction on Twitter over the weekend between Ben Smith, the excellent New York Times media columnist, and Matt Iglesias, the excellent Substack writer. Yes, I'm sorry, cringe face Matt Welch. They are excellent both in their own ways. And like Matt Iglesias is, you know, in many ways has been a critic of the occupation, at least for a while at this point. Although, you know, I think he started out in a little bit of a different place. And he's basically saying, you know, look, it's notable how biased, all of these folks are. They are not just sort of out there reporting the news. They are, in some sense, rooting for a specific outcome, and they're showing that in their coverage. And Ben Smith just sort of steps in and says, well, look, I think that's unfair. These reporters are really passionate about this, as if like that somehow or another sort of changes the equation. And, you know, look, we've talked about bias and, you know, whether it's possible to have objective news coverage on this podcast many times before. I think objectivity is the wrong standard, and I think it's impossible. I think transparency and accuracy are much better standards. But there really is just no real constituency in elite spaces for anti-interventionism. And the other thing is that I think is interesting here is just that the way this is being argued, I think, is kind of an own goal, right? So you hear a lot that, right, that the withdrawal was a mistake, or at the very least, it was really badly handled, right? And the argument is look, we shouldn't have pulled out, we shouldn't have pulled out now, or we shouldn't have pulled out the way we did, because look, this is a disaster. And, you know, in some ways, I think it is fair to criticize the exact way we left and the, you know, not doing what we should have done for the people who have been left there. But looked at another way, it just suggests that the whole project was doomed from the start. This was a rotten idea from day one. We spent 20 years, $1 trillion, plus something close to 2,500 American lives in an attempt to establish something like a free and stable Afghanistan, a sustainable nation of some sort. And even the people who are arguing, oh, look, it's just a peacekeeping force, you know, it's not nation building, they are arguing that we should leave those troops there forever, because that's the only thing that's sustainable. And so that was the goal. And that was what the U.S. foreign policy establishment was stumping for. And yet, within moments of our withdrawal, the entire edifice collapsed. And notably, the Taliban actually offered a surrender 20 years ago. They said they would back down. Yep. And we said no, because the Bush administration didn't want a surrender deal. They wanted to rout the Taliban because they assumed that killing all these guys would be easy. And 20 years later, we can see how they went. So after all that effort, after all of that expenditure in blood and treasure, the phrase you've heard 1,000 times, but it's real and meaningful. After all of that, the Taliban is arguably stronger than it was. You can make a case that our occupation enabled them and made them more powerful in their own home country, or at least that after 20 years, even if it wasn't our occupation that necessarily did that, that's the position we have left the country in, with a Taliban that is actually stronger than when we went in. And so this was
better equipped.
This was just a failure in every way from the beginning. And I think the failure of the pullout actually shows that this project was doomed from the beginning and was a bad idea from the start.
I think Stephen Wertheim, who was one of the co-founders of the Quincy Institute and is now at Columbia University, has earlier this summer wrote a really powerful essay looking forward to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And he said you know, that basically, rather than making the legacy of 9/11, how do we make America safer and Americans safer? We decided to try and make American military power, you know, absolutely indispensable. You know, and this is coming off of Madeleine Albright, who in, you know, the wake of that boring peace after the end of the Cold War in the late 90s, you know, she decided that America needed to be, in her phrase, the indispensable nation. And that it was like every time a traffic light was on the fritz somewhere, someplace on the planet, American troops and American force needed to be there to straighten things out. And that was the position that we took, rather than saying, okay, we want to make America safe, and then we want to engage the world in ways that will make it freer, more liberal as we understand it, and better, you know, allowing more people to decide for themselves how they want to live, including the ability to move freely from countries that are authoritarian or tyrannical coming back to us. And that is, you know, that was the major misstep. And I'll say, you know, I don't know if this is an original insight or not, but one of the things my girlfriend pointed out, you know, the most stunning image, and it, you know, I choke up even thinking about it, are those images of people in Afghanistan falling off a plane fuselage that are taking off because they, you know, and it's kind of like the way in Hanoi, you would see people like trying to hang on to the skids of helicopters as they were leaving the U.S. embassy, but people falling off of planes, trying to escape, you know, a quagmire in Afghanistan, a hell landscape that we help perpetuate and create. This is kind of, it's the image that pairs the beginning of 9/11, you know, that scene of people jumping from the Twin Towers. And we need to look at this 20-year interregnum of horrible, stupid, counterproductive, just awful foreign policy on the part of the United States. And we need to study it and remember it and learn from it so that going forward, we figure out ways where we are keeping America safe and we are actually being humanitarian in the way that we expand freedom and liberty around the world. And it's not going to come from the military. And it's not going to come from the State Department per se. It's got to come from other types of interactions, including cultural exchange, including freedom of, you know, more mobility of people across borders, especially into the U.S., especially if you help the U.S. in one of our misbegotten wars, and economic power and opening things up. And this is the essential lesson that we need to learn and kind of keep forefront in the forefront as the 20th anniversary of 9/11 comes into view.
Catherine, building on that, respond, if you will, to the argument that is common enough in the United States among various people that, you know, we shouldn't accept a single Afghan refugee before every American citizen comes out, and that, in generally speaking, what, we're going to get military-aged males from a Muslim country to come here, and we haven't vetted them. We can't do that. It's not the way to keep ourselves safe. American first, etc.
Yeah, I think some of this actually, I have like a very, very, very broad critique, which is just people should be a little less absolutist and simplistic in their thinking, which I recognize is a request that is absolutely never going to be granted. So I'll start there with the impossible. You know, it's the same thinking that leads to, you know, if a single child is saved, then all of the nanny state measures will have been worth it. It's the same thinking that leads to, you know, led to in some ways our presence in a variety of other global conflicts where we had humanitarian goals and ended up screwing things up. We just have to do the best that we can do. And so in a case like this, the best we can do is not going to be great. As we are getting out of Afghanistan, there are many, 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 many ways this could have gone better, including, at the very least, better planning for the orderly evacuation of people in the employ of the U.S. military there at the behest of the U.S. government, who we know who they are and have their paperwork, and we couldn't even get them out in a tidy way. But there is also, you know, we do have a lot of information about these tens of thousands of other people who have some legitimate claim to come to the United States, whether they are people who should be eligible for the SIV, program where the people who helped the U.S. In our work in Afghanistan, who we have promised or promised to promise a way out, as well as people who now legitimately fear for their lives because of the change in regime, which might include, for instance, basically every woman in the country. But those, you know, we have mechanisms to bring all of those people to the U.S. We have vetting mechanisms. I think that typically those vetting mechanisms are too stringent, but it's not as if we have to invent this system from whole cloth. Like, this is something we've done before. We could do it again. There's nothing that says the order of precedence has to be the very last American out before the very first Afghan in. That's never how we've operated. And particularly if we have such a large constituency of people saying the very last American will never be out, then that's just a sort of backward or kind of opaque way of saying we're never going to let any Afghans in. And that is clearly morally not the right stance, nor is it what our laws allow and require. Refugees have claimed to come here, and many of these people would be refugees. So I would like to see people be a little bit more flexible in their thinking. And also, you know, if you are a law and order person, our laws already have a huge amount of capacity to bring people here legally, safely, with a certain amount of vetting. If we are not doing that, it is because we are choosing not to do it, not because they would somehow be illegal and by extension, dangerous. That's a misunderstanding of who these people are.
From a pragmatic point of view, the way, and we did this with Iraq, we did this even at the highest level with somebody like Muammar Gaddafi, who had been cooperating with the United States, or Hosni Mubarak, who was almost Egypt was almost a client state. But at the highest level, we do not take care of the people who we ally with and we make promises to. And, you know, so I think Catherine's right. There's a moral principle here that takes clear precedent, but it's also, we have been continually telling allies over at least the past 20 years, when you get into trouble, we're out of there. We're not going to help you. And when we're trying to build alliances to reduce the scope of whether it's Islamic terrorism or other types of insurgencies around the world, you would have to be an idiot to actually trust that the American government is going to, actually follow through on its promises to you. We're very bad at that. And, again, just from a pragmatic point of view, as well as a moral one. And I would also add, just, you see this particularly in Trump type responses to this, where it's like, Biden is screwing things up because he took too long to get people out. Trump is great because he got us out of Afghanistan. But the important thing is that we don't honor any alliances we had with the people in Afghanistan that we helped. It's just a dead worldview. I mean, it is really, it's just dead fish heads all the way through on this type of topic.
Roly poly, eat them up, yum. Final little fact lit before we switch gears is that over the past 10 years, the worldwide population of refugees has essentially doubled from 10 million to 20 million. It's rough numbers. And during that time, prior to COVID, mind you, the U.S. took its numbers to all-time lows. Worth keeping in the back of your head. Okay, shifting gears, we had breaking news this morning, which is when we're taping this podcast, although you're consuming it right away in the afternoon, that, quote, U.S. regulators have given full approval to Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine, unquote, which may sound weird to those many millions of us who got the Pfizer jab months ago. So, Suderman, what does this mean? What will be the immediate practical effects of this decision by the FDA?
Well, this means that the Pfizer vaccine, and that's Pfizer only, not Moderna, not J&J, is now officially, permanently, fully approved by the FDA. So prior to this, it had been operating under an emergency use authorization granted in December. And what this means practically in the short term is that some institutions and businesses are probably going to end up pursuing vaccine mandates for their employees and for, say, college students, right? So for people that they deal with or do business with. So it's hard to have a mandate, say, at a public university for students to be vaccinated if that vaccine has not been fully approved. But now that the Pfizer vaccine is fully approved, and we can reasonably expect that the Moderna vaccine, which is the other mRNA vaccine, is probably going to be approved within a month or so. Now that sort of that has happened, the military is definitely going to require that everybody who is in active service be vaccinated, I believe, by the middle of September or so. Big employers like Walmart are going to go through with vaccination requirements. This will probably mean that that some colleges go through with it, and that if there are legal challenges, those legal challenges are going to face a bigger hurdle. It also means, I think, I hope it means that some people who had held out on getting vaccinated are more likely to go through and say, look, this has been fully approved now. And that has been, I think, a big concern, because the FDA, the CDC, the sort of the public health establishment in the U.S. government has really been delivering just terribly mixed messages up until now. So we have heard over and over again from people at very high levels in the government who work in public health, you must get vaccinated. It is a great idea. I think actually getting vaccinated is a great idea, to be clear. And then at the same time, the FDA has not officially approved these vaccines. And the reason that they have held out, technically, their official position has been that we're still not sure about the safety data. So even though the FDA has been saying, look, yeah, it's really a good idea to get vaccinated, please get vaccinated, they've also been saying, with the other hand, with their sort of official process, actually, we're not so sure about this thing. And it has just contributed to a really mixed and muddled message coming from federal public health authorities about whether or not these vaccines are a good idea. To be clear, I think they are. My hope is that this should have happened sooner, but now that it has happened, that more people will feel like it is okay to get vaccinated and like the vaccines are safe. On the other hand, I don't think that the FDA's stamp of official approval should be the deciding factor. For some people, however, it may well be.
Catherine, Reason has written oodles, Google oodles. What was that word that we used to use? I forget now.
Lots.
That's
shit
a bunch.
Ton.
Yeah. Anyway,
metric shit ton.
A bunch on how the FDA should probably just be abolished anyways, that these drug approvals should happen faster, etc. But I'm going to invite you to respond to a critique that you hear among some self-identified libertarians. That this vaccine is experimental, it's unproven, it's even rushed, it's being foisted upon us by an unholy alliance between big pharma and big government. What say you, EIC of Reason?
Yeah, first of all, abolish the FDA. Always start there and there. That's how the conversation goes. But also, the FDA has, as Suderman noted, has really, along with the rest of the kind of public health apparatus, screwed up in saying both, you are a monster if you don't get a vaccine. And also, we are not going to definitively pronounce on whether this vaccine is safe. Like that right there is a serious tension that was an unforced error on the part of the federal government. I think that the approval is long overdue. I think if the FDA must exist, it should exist at a function and perform a much lower level function, which is just to provide information and not to create legal or illegal categories for drugs, and also that the FDA is notoriously bad at delaying drugs because it needs to prove efficacy. In this case, the efficacy seems really clear, and the safety question is what seems to loom larger in people's minds. I think that's a fair concern for individuals to have. And I will say I am very much I have two responses simultaneously to this morning's news about the FDA changing the status of the Pfizer vaccine. And the first is, thank God, it's about time. These jerks have been dragging their feet for too long. And the other is, uh-oh, here we go on the end stage heating up of the battle over mandates, because as Peter notes, the lack of formal status for any of these vaccines has been holding back many, many, many institutions from putting vaccine mandates in place. To be clear, I think it is fine for private employers to require people who want to work for them to get a vaccine. I think that a reasonable and compassionate employer should also provide alternatives. They should say, you can do weekly testing. You can work from home to the extent that that is still, that you can still do your job. I would like for employers to be able to be flexible, because there are people who have legitimate reasons not to want to get the vaccine. I also think that there is a lot of gray area between real legitimate reasons, irrational, but still, you know, worth honoring if possible reasons. But there are, we are now going to be in a situation where we're going to be in all-out warfare, where each entity that says you must get a vaccine to do business with us, to work here, whatever it is, will be treated as the same thing as a broad-based national mandate. I would love to make space for pro-vaccine, anti-public mandate. There is a lot of gray area in there, and it does not have to be a war of all against all. The approval of the Pfizer vaccine, while good news and long overdue, is going to trigger a very, very furious fight over vaccine mandates. So much so, by the way, that I would like to make a prediction that we will go back to essentially the 2020 Afghanistan coverage status in a couple of weeks. I think people will really mostly forget about Afghanistan again, because we will be so consumed with fighting about COVID-related issues and vaccine mandates here at home. I think that the evening news is going to go back to its 5 minutes a year diet, if I had to say.
Hey, Catherine, can I ask you, private employers should have a right. I mean, I think everybody from a libertarian perspective agrees
employers. I would say most people who identify as libertarians rights. Do not currently agree with that. And that's something I would like
to
change.
But what about public employers? Because, right. You know, the place where this
that
is actually hitting the fan is public school teachers and college students going to state universities, which are, you know, 85% or something of college students by number go to state-funded or state-assisted universities. So where do you think?
There's also the military, on that? Which has said that it's going to require full vaccination starting, I believe,
but
in
the military is always allowed a lot more, but that also has, that's always had much more room to be like, hey, you got to cut your hair to work here. You got to do this. You got to do that.
Yeah. Here's my view. But I think this is an area where it does get trickier, and maybe reasonable libertarians can disagree. I think that if we are talking about employment in this country is at will. So I think it is within the rights of any employer, public or private, to say, if you would like to continue working here, these are the terms of your employment. And one of the terms of your employment could well be getting vaccinated. I know that that is not something that every libertarian agrees with me on, but I think that that is freedom of association, that is freedom of contract. To me, this seems relatively straightforward, and the fact that that employer might be a public entity does not change my view on that matter. I think that with schooling, there is this tricky problem of public schooling is mandatory for people under the age of 18. So we right now have a situation which is in many ways the worst case scenario. We do not have approval for a vaccine for kids. We do not have a clear timeline for that approval. We have a requirement that children attend school or file an extensive amount of paperwork and show your homeschooling plan, blah, blah, blah. Essentially a schooling requirement. Because of that, I see teachers as a special class here. The civilian population is forced to interact with teachers. They have no choice about it under the current laws. And so in that case, I think that teachers become akin to police officers. You know, we don't have a choice but when we interact with the police. And so I think in those cases, vaccine mandates are particularly important and advisable, even though they are public employees, even though there are complications. I do think that, especially as long as we are in this gray middle ground, mandates for teachers and police officers and other members of the government that the public has no choice but to interact with, that a vaccine mandate is especially appropriate.
Within minutes of the announcement by the FDA this morning, the Department of Education in New York City, which employs 148,000 people, Catherine. 148,000 people announced that all employees will have to get their first shot by September 27th. Full vax mandate, no more testing out option. Every adult in school buildings is going to have to get a vaccine. Bill de Blasio has repeatedly said schools are going to be open and we're not going to have a distance requirement. We'll see how that butts up against quarantining rules and frequent testing and a bunch of other things. We're going to get talk more, hopefully, at the back half of this show about some of the implications here and stuff like vaccine passports and the political fights thereof. But we do want to get to our email of the week. But even before we get to the email of the week, a word from BetterHelp. Are you being held back, blunted, stymied, thwarted by depression, stress, anxiety, and or insomnia? You could do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable, of course, to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what 1,000 weather anchors need to pronounce Henri, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available, even though the service is pretty affordable to begin with. Go to the website, betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred delivery methods. They'll get back to you within 24 hours with someone to talk to. And if you don't like that person, you can get another one right away. Please visit betterhelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, I just want to say that you beautiful people have been sending us some super high quality emails recently, and my only regret in life, really, is that we can't get to all of them. But keep them coming anyways to roundtable@reason.com. Today's comes from the marvelously named Megan Aubuchon, who writes in part, "Hey, y'all, thank you for producing one of the few podcasts I care to listen to. That's what I like to hear. And for being some of my best friends in this closed off world. While I am a longtime listener, magazine subscriber, and general consumer of all things Reason," again, love to hear that, I found myself disheartened while scrolling the website tonight. It's 95-5 ratio of negative to positive stories in there, people. Megan, that's 19-1. You could just, like, there's a comment. If I'm being generous, she goes on. "The podcast brings me so much joy, I shall never yeet them." I don't know what that means. "But the articles, where are all the positive stories? Surely there's something happening today that does not suck. Maybe Amash moved closer to running in 2024, or maybe a libertarian won a county-level government position somewhere. Anybody on the team got a new puppy? Is there something good somewhere? Please? The contrast is so stark, I wonder, does the casual nature of the podcast simply allow your collective pluckiness..." You hear that, Nick? Pluckiness. "To calm my nerves. Or maybe the website reflects a more unvarnished reality. It is right now just an absolute shit time to be a libertarian. A good news only filter for hard days would be lovely. Catherine, help this Neal Stephenson fan out, please."
Yeah, I would like there to be more good news, too. And I actually, as Matt so often mentions, as the person in charge of all the things at The Reason, I am always trying to find ways to lean into good news. But yeah, it's a tough minute. I'm not going to lie. I'm doing a lot of media consumption that is essentially self-soothing in the face of the news these days. Like, I rewatched Outlander this weekend, you guys. That's the stage, man, I'm at. So just
the entire show?
No, like just a chunk of it. But the fact that I'm like not even willing to brave the possibility of being disappointed by a new junky science fiction book and need to go there means that I have a lot of sympathy with our letter writer. I will note that today, on the main page, we have a great Reason video about one of our favorite subjects, George Hutz, who is always out here trying to build self-driving cars out of robots that are from the Jetsons, who is going to do it for only like $50 in his garage. Tech news.
By repurposing a Juul pod.
Yeah. Yeah. It's powered by mango Juul pods. So that's a problem because those are illegal now. Oh no, it's bad news again. Yeah, so tech news is my solace in these dark times. And so I would recommend to you, dear writer, both The Reason TV output, which does tend toward the more optimistic of our various platforms. And also to say that, yeah, there's just a lot of bad news right now, unfortunately. I do not consider Libertarian Party people winning dog catcher elections to be like enough good enough news to counterbalance all the bad news. We do try to cover that stuff when something that seems sort of significant happens. But I certainly don't look for my good news in electoral politics. I look entirely outside of politics. And I hope that the site does reflect that on the regular.
I would also just say we're critics of the state, and being a critic means focusing people on priorities. And the priority is, it is in many cases, the problem that needs to be fixed. And so we do other things, right? And we're not just critics of the state. We have a vision that's much larger than that. But part of being a critic means saying, look, the places where we need to put effort, the things we need to focus on in some sense are the problems that need to be fixed. And so part of what we do is we point to problems that need to be fixed.
Also on the site today, Ron Bailey on a new kind of infinitely recyclable plastic. So Ron Bailey is good for good news a lot of times.
Although he's sadder than he used to be.
Well, no, Ron is truly the darkest the darkest optimist among us. Like he's darker
than Nick?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Ron can speak for himself, but he is.
At least before about 3 o'clock.
He has sad, sad eyes. Ron's eyes look sad now, you guys, even though he keeps writing stories for us about infinitely recyclable plastic.
But, you know, this is the, I think the reader gets at a real issue that we need to kind of address as, you know, not the Libertarian Party, but the Libertarian movement, small L, small M. And reason in general, which is that, you know, there have been a massive number of wins, I think, from a libertarian perspective, you know, during the time that reason has been in existence since 1968. And I have a handy list here that I keep on my desk so that I don't go dark all the time. But it's like, you know, free speech, you know, the end of obscenity laws, et cetera. The anti-war movement has never been stronger. You know, unfortunately, it took, you know, 20 years of disaster to get there. There's a vibrant move against state surveillance. Safetyism generally, which has been growing since the 90s, is also being attacked. And when you look back at pieces that we wrote in Reason, you know, I wrote the thing about childproofing the world in 97. You know, fast forward through the free-range parenting movement, as well as the coddling of the American mind, we are at least confronting this. The, you know, massive cornucopia of culture is everywhere, but we don't recognize, you know, the fact that you can now produce and consume virtually all culture that you want on your own terms. We've somehow either, you know, just kind of ignore that or see it as a problem, which is a problem. School choice is doing great. Free trade and free markets are under attack, but they're more in place than they were 50 years ago, certainly. Matt, you've written about this, the democratization of just about everything, where people at all stations of life are better off and have more options than they used. Marriage equality, criminal justice reform, including asset forfeiture, sentencing reform, mandatory minimums ending. Drug policy is going in the right direction. Occupational licensing has been identified as a problem and is being dismantled. Libertarian legal theory that somebody like Damon Root talks about, the critique of the administrative state is growing. You know, there are losses. There's no question the government is bigger than ever, and we are in a period where the ratchet is swinging up very quickly and probably securely. But there's a lot of really good things going on within the political arena, and then more culturally, you know, we're building out different visions of the world. And it is true that the video team probably looks at that more so. You know, things like private space exploration, which is something, you know, Catherine is very interested in. Peter could point to, you know, the robustness of a, you know, a self-generated, a drinks culture is putting it too poorly, but it's too small or too restricted. But like, people are creating meaning in the world in a way that is positive and upbeat. We do cover that. I think at times we go into a dark place where this has always been a problem with the libertarian worldview. We end up sometimes being so focused on the state. You know, we're like, a post office is still a problem. But we live in a world where Most people never fucking go to the post office. You know, like, we win. We win, but we don't recognize when we're winning.
I mean, things are definitely a lot better than they were in, I don't know, like 1743 in the Scottish Highlands.
No. But in 1983, there's so much better.
This is right. And this is a thing that I sort of think about a lot, is just that the cultural bounty of the late internet era that we live in is really incredible and often taken for granted. And I just, you know, remember growing up in like a not big city, a small town in the Florida panhandle, right? Where I think our questioner spent some time, and how hard it was to find and access music and movies that I was interested in. And even if you could find them, it was incredibly expensive. I mean, you could sometimes get things shipped and it would be 6 to 12 weeks of shipping, and it would cost you $40 to get, you know, one VHS tape shipped from New York or California or something. And now every time I fire up one of the music streaming services, and I have a couple of them because they're all so wonderful, I have to like pinch myself because I have, to a first approximation, nearly every album, just nearly every song and every album of any note released over the last at least 50, if not 75 years. And it's kind of like magic, right? It's just, it's all there, and it's $10 or $15 a month. And it's really sort of strange and incredible. And for those of us who grew up like driving hours and hours and hours to go to small hole in the wall shops to find things, it's a huge, huge life changer.
Just a important note that I discovered over the weekend on that streaming tip. A Tribe Called Quest is now on Spotify. That was the holdout. They're back in. I've been 90s-ing a little bit. Would I also add, speaking of 90s-ing, that it's not a small thing to me that extreme poverty has mostly vanished on the globe in the past 30 years, which nobody predicted. It was not, that was not in the Magic 8 Ball as one of the outcomes in 1991. That just wasn't there.
In 2000,
yeah.
If you look at the UN projections.
Right, yeah, they had a millennium, right? The millennium goal or whatever. And they kind of zoomed through that so much faster than ever. And also, if you look at their documents trying to figure out why that happened, they're like, yeah, it wasn't aid, it was trade. Wow.
Yeah.
We didn't want to conclude that, but there we go.
I mean, all the things that y'all just described are absolutely good news. And we do occasionally do thinky pieces about that, but they're not actually good news, right? And this is like, the front page of our website is full of the news. And I think that's a thing that that is still a real gap, is like there is not a lot of good news, like a new thing that happened today for people who are big fans of Free Minds and Free Markets. You have to really go looking for it. This is a good reminder. This letter is a good reminder to go looking for it. But there, you know, I think it is not wrong to say like it's kind of a dark time right now. And that's okay. We can both say the trend line is good and the moment is bad.
Two words for you. Shohei Ohtani. Fixes a lot of problems. Just live it, learn it, love it. We should go to our end of podcast stuff, but I want to do a quick round just following up on the mandates, the vaccine mandate stuff that is going to be hitting us. We already see in New York City, where Nick and I are right now, and Catherine's not far away because we didn't destroy her with a hurricane, has introduced its own kind of easy to fool vaccine mandates for people to go indoors in most places. The same has happened in San Francisco. I would predict that we will see that maybe statewide in California sooner rather than later. It's also happening in New Orleans. Canada doesn't allow you to get on a plane or, as far as I know, a international border crossing boat, or even not a boat, maybe, or even not a border crossing. Anyways, you got to have a vaccine mandate before, you got to proof of vaccination before you travel. So this stuff is going to be with us in a big way, Catherine. And you mentioned that you're shaking at the politics of it all kind of preemptively. We'd like to invite you to sort of reflect on a point made that I'm scrolling to by Eric Nelson, who's a book publisher of conservative books, who is a libertarian. I don't know if the numbers are right, but the sentiment is interesting. Since May 1st, he wrote this weekend, two countries are living side by side. In one, about 100 people die of COVID every week. In the other, about 3,300. the first country made up of vaccinated people and children, doesn't need precautions, but will probably take them. The second does, but probably won't. Those are broad strokes. And again, the numbers I can't necessarily vouch for, although he tends to be careful. But like the politics of it, we're going to go into a pretty weird and bad place, Catherine. What do you worry about right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I really prize and value a thing about American culture, which is that Americans don't like to be told what to do. This is like one of our signature cultural attributes. It's maybe screwing us over a little bit right now. I'm not going to lie. There are downsides to that attribute. Canadians seem to be much, much more chill about being told what to do. They just do it and they say, thank you, may I have another. This is I think, a huge, huge study in how much more culture matters in politics. I mean, in a way, this is just me channeling the Nick Gillespie here. You know, we can try to make a lot of rules. Our governments can try to make a lot of rules telling people how to behave. And that is not going to go well here because that is not how Americans roll. And so I think, you know, it remains important to convince Americans to protect each other and keep each other safe, convince them, not require them. And the mandates like the ones that are in New York City now, the ones that are happening in California, the ones that I do think will soon be proposed all around the country, I think are really wrongheaded and dangerous. And they are going to create far more backlash than they are going to do good. I do not like to see governments telling people what to do. Even when it is our Canadian brothers, and even when they don't seem to mind it so much.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what you have all been consuming. Nick, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, sure. I watched on HBO the White Lotus, a short miniseries about a luxury resort and spa in Hawaii, which attempts to be a scathing indictment of kind of upper class white privilege. And it starts off, it has the first episode sets up a nice kind of mystery of somebody has been killed. And then you know you're going to find out who was killed, and you think you know who it is from the beginning. There's a nice twist at the end. But ultimately, it is a failed show, which I think more reflects the inability of Hollywood, particularly prestige Hollywood, to seriously accept and understand capitalism and the bounty that it brings, without kind of falling into cheap stereotypes that end up then becoming, in the name of being anti-capitalist, there's a kind of division between people who work at the resort and people who go to the resort. And it's a muddle and a mess. And for that reason, I wouldn't recommend it as like, this is a great show and it really made me think about what the creators are trying to do. But more, this is a case study in the inability of kind of elite culture makers to understand and to live within a system that gives them inordinate power and reach and the possibility of, you know, of living spectacular lives. So that's what I watch, The White Lotus.
I have been reading Ship of Magic, a 1998 fantasy novel by author Robin Hobb. I've mentioned some of her work before. I read her first big fantasy trilogy over the last year, and this is the follow-up to it. So it takes place in the same world, but somewhat different region and with entirely different characters and some new magical elements in particular. This is a series that is built around what are called live ships. And so these are ships that, after many generations of being used by the same family, come alive and have personalities. And so that, yeah, there's a bunch of interesting wrinkles. The ships themselves are really interesting characters. This book reads like a season of great television. It's multivocal, multi-character, a lot of characters, unlike the last book, which had one single, the last trilogy, I should say, which had one single perspective character. She here has a big cast and allows all of them time to sort of shine and sort of have their own moments and gets into their heads, even some of the characters who we are pretty clearly supposed to see as villains to some extent. And what's interesting about this is that even the villains, you sort of get to see how they think and what they are interested in. I wouldn't say that they are sympathetic exactly, but they come across in many ways as understandable. And she's not simply trying to portray bad people as bad for their, like, as, oh, these people are just solely and simply bad. She says that, look, these people might be doing bad things. They might be engaging in awful, predatory, unethical behaviors, but they have their reasons and they are actually thoughtful about these sorts of things and they have a way of understanding the world. And so there is a kind of remarkable empathy in these books that I think is missing from a lot of modern fiction, which just ends up being sort of ideologically didactic and saying that, you know, people who are bad are essentially and wholly bad. And there's also some interesting politics and economics in these books because this is a sort of pre-modern world where governments have been set up, where there are rulers and where there are laws and agreements. But she has an almost anarchistic view of those laws and those governments, just in the sense that she is constantly writing about the ways in which those laws can be bent, agreements can be broken, in which systems of governance and and human social organization exist entirely based on trust and based on people's willingness to sort of, right, a collective willingness to uphold laws and systems of organizing society. And so she sees them as, in some sense, contingent rather than as permanent fixtures of how humans organize themselves. And so it's a really fascinating book. It's a little bit on, like, too long, maybe. It's about 800 pages. And I think probably she could have trimmed this back to 600 or so. On the other hand, this is one of the few books that I enjoy, despite thinking that it's too long and despite seeing that this is part of a trilogy of 800-page books. And I know that the plot lines are not going to fully resolve here in book one. And yet I'm still enjoying it just for sort of living with these characters and getting to see how this world works. It's so rich, so deep, and just kind of just incredibly pleasurable to just get lost in.
I would like to continue my series of recommending the occasional children's podcast and say that my family is listening to the National Geographic Greeking Out podcast, which is it's about Greek myths. And it is also set in a pet shop. So Zeus is a hamster. And in some ways, that's all you need to know, except for I do think it is also important to say that Ares is a pug, which is fitting because Ares is the worst god and pugs are the worst.
Aw, dogs.
Dogs.
Aw. I like Ares now.
That's my smoking hot take on both dogs and Greek gods. But no, the podcast is good. There's a couple of seasons. And if you, like me as a child and also me as a parent, find that there is a weird appeal of Greek mythology for a certain type of kid, this is a good way to further inhabit the Greek myth expanded universe.
Are there hamster lightning bolts?
I mean, I don't know if I want to give spoilers, Peter.
Yeah. I watched a movie that I recommend, although it's not great. It's called Motherless Brooklyn. This is an Edward Norton written, produced, directed. And anytime you have like some, it took him 20 years to do this project that meant so much from an actor, you know that there's definitely going to be a whole lot of scenery chewing in this, which is one of the reasons to recommend it, because I always like to watch people overact. He plays it's a noir detective thing based on the 1999 Jonathan Lethem book. The gimmick is that he's got Tourette's. So he's got the tick and he's just like always sort of like barking things out and snapping his neck for 2 hours. So that's fun. But what makes it interesting, particularly for libertarian viewers, is that the novel is set, and it's been recommended to me for a long time, but I haven't read it. It's set in the neighborhood that I'm sitting here in, or it's in some kind of, you know, Brooklyn, brownstone-ish area, but it's contemporary of the times. What Ed Norton did is made it into a noir about how evil Robert Moses is. It's kind of great. Alec Baldwin plays Robert Moses as a scenery chewing, like, awful person who just, like, smashes all the little people and abuses his power. He basically transposed Robert Caro's The Power Broker onto a detective novel that had nothing to do with any of that stuff. And so you have Jane Jacobs characters there. You've got, like, Willem Dafoe playing a crazy, you know, weird brother genius guy. Bruce Willis, just, like, it's actually pretty interesting, super libertarian by accident, kind of critique of unaccountable power that looks at individuals and little people as the problem to smash and to root around. Pretty fun. And the music is phenomenal. It's a really great jazz soundtrack. And
I would just add one more recommendation for the original novel, which is great for people who like twists on the detective novel. And it's not libertarian in the same sort of way, but it's great, punchy, short, really focused novel that is this built around like something you would think is, oh man, this is right. Here's a Tourette's detective. And like, we're going to get his narration. And so you've got to just constantly be reading through like the way his brain is working. And you would think that this is a gimmick, and somehow or another, it's actually endearing and draws you into the character and makes the book work better.
All right. Those are all the noir-like adaptations that we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. You know what to do. Keep listening to us. Keep sending us your emails. In fact, if you want to email us and say, hey, look, there's this bit of good news that you're not covering on the website that I think is very interesting and important and is not necessarily a by-election of dog catcher in a county with 12 people, please send them to at the roundtable and I'll forward it to the proper authority, etc. But like, we want to hear that too, and we want to present you with new and exciting things as well. As for podcasts, just go to reason.com/podcasts and go listen to them. Okay, bye.